Welcome to Oncology Today, Colorectal Cancer Edition, a special program focused on recently published and emerging research in the management of colorectal cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met jointly with Dr. Axel Grothy from West Cancer Center in Germantown, Tennessee, and Dr. Michael Overman from the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas. To begin, I asked Dr. Grothy to comment on biomarker analysis for patients with colorectal cancer.
In the last years, we have really started to molecularly profile patients with metastatic colorectal cancer, and with the idea that we identify patients with targetable mutations or alterations that can really guide our therapy approaches in first line and later line of therapy. So the molecular profile that we, for instance, do at MD West Cancer Center and probably also at MD Anderson is comprehensive next-generation sequencing profile that identifies mutations, but also potential fusions, and of course immunohistochemistry for mismatch repair deficiency to identify candidates for immunotherapy. HER2-targeted agents, you know, potentially for the HER2 overexpressors. So I think at about 21-22% of patients, we identify alteration that at least in theory can be targetable. The most common ones, BRAF V600E, where we do have treatment options available, HER2, MSI-high, mismatch repair deficient tumors. Those are the ones that we definitely use for positive treatment decisions. Then on the other hand, we also profile patients and tumors to identify patients who are not candidates for EGF receptor antibody therapies, the RAS mutant tumors, NRAS and KRAS mutant tumors. So that's really led into the comprehensive molecular profiling history of metastatic colorectal cancer.
Mike, any comments on this, particularly as it relates to immunotherapy? Can you comment again on genomic markers in colorectal cancer?
Yeah, I think, you know, we've seen this increasing number of clinically relevant kind of genomic markers that has really come to the fore. We've known a lot of different alterations, but now we really have ones that are clinically engageable that really predict us to do something different. And that number is just increasing. You've heard about it, Axel, talking about RAS, BRAF, HER2. MSI, mismatch repair, you know, TMB, we can even talk about. And so I really think that as we accumulate these numbers, it really leads to the fundamental kind of change in which really we need to start moving towards a large next generation sequencing panel that's capturing all these various kind of required alterations that are actually engageable, even fusions, right? Very rare, but still something that we have therapies for. And so as I think these increase in regards to the clinical engagement range, it really means that we really have to start looking at a broad next generation sequencing panel that really covers all these aspects. And a lot of different companies and availability have that. But I think we're going to see that more and more as the critical kind of testing going forward.
Mike, any comment about liquid biopsies?
You know, in colorectal cancer in general, a lot of times we have tissue, right? Often it's accessible, the primary metastatic site. And so often I think, you know, tumor is available. I think clearly liquid biopsy makes a lot of sense. You have an adequate tumor sample. And so that's an obvious kind of space to be using it as your molecular profiling. I think in the colorectal space where we see it more providing a unique aspect to care is really in the case where you're actually looking for that ctDNA in regards to a potential change. So there's some interesting data in regards to EGFR and acquired resistance and that evolving over time and the ability to assess for that using ctDNA. So do you have acquired RAS mutations that then decline and you can potentially consider engaging again with EGFR therapy as one option? So this acquired resistance kind of question that potentially has a role even in clinical practice. And then I think the minimal residual disease setting. So you're looking after a surgical intervention and you're looking to see, is there kind of a minimal residual disease as detected by circulating tumor DNA? And I think those are the two kind of real kind of unique spaces that I think we'll see a lot more interest and engagement with circulating tumor DNA in the colorectal space.
Axel, can you comment on a little about the issue of sidedness? You had this slide in your deck, and maybe not just the empiric data that we have, but the biology behind this.
Yeah, so we have known for quite some time that left-side and right-sided tumors do behave differently. The data going back to early 2000s when we just used 5-FU-based therapy, that right-sided tumors actually had a shorter survival at the time when we didn't even think about targeted agents or molecular biology as much. And over time, we've actually realized there are so many differences between left and right-sided tumors. And it's not really probably a distinct kind of you know, that there's a crossing, you know, with the splenic flexure between right and left. There's probably more continuous difference between gene expression levels and actually also the microbiota that are present in the colon in different areas. So right-sided tumors are more aggressive, are characterized by higher likelihood to be BRAF mutated, MSI high. And again, they have different bacterial colonization than left-sided tumors, where we see more RAS mutations and HER2 overexpression. So all this together, and there are probably a lot of unknown factors that we haven't even identified yet, including gene expression levels that are different between left and right-sided tumors. All this leads to different prognosis, but also different predictive markers that can influence our treatment approaches, in particular with regard to EGF receptor antibody therapy right now, and immunotherapy, given the fact that right-sided tumors are more likely to be MSI high, BRAF mutation, so more targeted agents for right-sided tumors when we target the MAP kinase pathway.
So Axel, you had this slide on, quote, the perfect candidate for first-line EGFR monoclonal antibody. And of course, the sidedness issue relates a lot to these kinds of questions. Can you comment?
This slide is, I think, very relevant for clinical practice and has influenced my practice quite a bit, because in the US, we're so used to giving bevacizumab in first-line therapy. I think, you know, most patients still receive FOLFOX plus bevacizumab as their first-line treatment, regardless of sidedness or, you know, molecular profile. But I actually have used more EGF receptor antibodies now that I believe I know who these patients are who can benefit, kind of refined patient population that really benefits from EGF receptor antibodies, which are the RAS wild-type, BRAF wild-type, non-HER2 overexpressors. And all these different factors on the slide, you know, the molecular markers are largely mutually exclusive, so they add up on top of each other. And then we have also learned from various retrospective analysis of prospectively conducted trials that right-sided cancer, at least not in first-line therapy, do not benefit from EGF receptor antibody therapies. That's not mutually exclusive. That's overlapping. So I believe in the end, there are probably about 25% of patients with left-sided RAS-RAF wild-type tumors that really should receive an EGF receptor antibody in first-line. That's what I use in my clinical practice.
And does that apply also to patients who are not symptomatic, Axel, or are you more symptomatic patients?
That's a great question. I mean, so let's say the intensity of therapy, whether or not we use a doublet or a triplet with or without biologic agents, really depends on goal of therapy. Do we need to induce a response? You know, is there a need, for instance, to turn things around rapidly, let's say in kinetic of response, the depth of response? And there are definitely patients that are kind of outliers that don't follow the guideline that I just mentioned. You know, if you have a smoldering disease and not a lot of cancer, elderly patient, you might get away with just, for instance, capecitabine bevacizumab treatment, even in left-sided RAS-RAF wild-type tumors. So it's one of the components that we use to identify the best treatment for patients. So goal of therapy, the need for a response, which is higher when we use EGF receptor antibodies, definitely factors into the treatment decision here.
Mike, could you talk a little bit about how you approach the issue of using EGFR antibodies in metastatic disease?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think Axel did a great job of kind of selecting out the right patient. And I think that's really kind of the key. And I think, you know, the EGFR data in the frontline and the right patient is really strong, randomized, good data. And so I think there's no doubt that EGFR therapy in a frontline in the right patient is really an excellent active option for patients. And I would say in the United States, potentially, we should, you know, be considering using that more. I think the key issue is that you do need your, you know, sequencing data up front to really be able to select that patient. And so that's one of the key criteria to doing that. But I mean, I think we can even talk about the recent, you know, PANDA clinical trial that was, you know, presented at ASCO that looked at FOLFOX panitumumab versus 5-FU panitumumab, which I thought was elderly patients with metastatic colorectal cancer, which I thought was an excellent study, because really showing that if you select the right patient, you can actually get equivalency, basically. So it's kind of similar outcomes between the two, demonstrating that you select the right patient for panitumumab, you can have activity that's equivalent without even having to give oxaliplatin to this kind of elderly population. I think just getting the fact that you select the right patient, you can really have success in EGFR therapy. So I think that applies frontline clearly, but also applies, as we can talk about, second and third line as well, in regards to kind of the selection of the HER2, BRAF, and RAS status, and then sidedness.
That's interesting. Have you used capecitabine or 5-FU with an EGFR antibody, Mike?
In frontline, I have not, you know, but I have always thought that if you can, you know, select the right patient. There are clearly patients, historically, we've known this for a while, there are patients you give EGFR therapy to and it works fantastically well, right? We have seen that consistently for a number of years. And so the question has always been, who is that right patient, right? Even in the very beginning, when EGFR came onto the scene, we clearly knew that the vast majority of patients weren't benefiting at all. And that's when we then developed, you know, RAS, but clearly that improved it, but there are still a large number of patients not benefiting. And we're getting to the point that we understand it well enough that we're really selecting out that group that really has a high chance of responding. So it gets to the point of, you know, could that be a monotherapy for the right patient that's really active? And so I think that, you know, is something that is in the maintenance space is something I do clearly consider using in kind of later lines. I think the PANDA study is very interesting, and I think is one that would be a very rational and reasonable approach as well, kind of in the elderly patient where you want to not have intensity, considering a, you know, fluoropyrimidine kind of anti-EGFR for the right selected patient that we've just talked about.
So I want to go through a case here. Axel had a 58-year-old patient. Axel, before you talk about him, have you tried this strategy of, you know, fluorouracil capecitabine / EGFR antibody without other chemotherapy?
So I have not yet used capecitabine in combination with an EGF receptor antibody based on some, let's say, conflicting or negative data from UK studies. But I've used 5-FU-panitumab, for instance, and as a maintenance therapy mainly. I've, similar to Mike, I've not yet used 5-FU-panitumab as first-line treatment in the select patients. But, you know, the PANDA study is interesting for elderly patients. Definitely, it's one of those points to consider.
Yeah, it is interesting. How about this 58-year-old man? I mean, without going through every single part of the case, Axel, maybe you can just kind of focus on some of the key points.
So this was a patient close by in Jackson, Tennessee, who had a very high tumor burden when I saw him, left-sided cancer, high CA levels, over 52,000 actually in the end. And he really needed a response. Unfortunately, we already had a rapid turnaround of a molecular profile. He was RAS, BRAF wild type, MSS, HER2 negative, NTRK negative. And in this case, I actually used FOLFOXIRI plus panitumumab based on some data from a German randomized study. You see here, this is a situation on the scan when you see the liver doesn't have a lot of leeway to get even worse. And, you know, this one of those patients where I'm also concerned if this tumor grows and doesn't really have a rapid response, you will not be able to potentially use irinotecan because you'll have intrahepatic cholestasis and bilirubin will go up. So that's one of those areas where I believe, you know, triplet chemotherapy plus, in this case, biologic panitumumab really made a lot of sense. And lo and behold, I mean, this patient had a rapid and lasting response. Primary tumor was still in place. He really had excellent tolerability, some rash on his face and scalp and upper trunk, and then had a rapid and long-lasting response, which allowed me actually, after 8 cycles, to de-escalate the treatment. And at that point, we really talked about, should we use panitumumab as maintenance therapy? But, you know, I'm a little bit concerned about long-term EGF receptor antibody therapy as maintenance, because, as Mike alluded to, we know that there are resistance mechanisms that come up. We see the emergence of RAS mutant clones, actually. So I did, in this case, chose to go for kind of a Kyro-3-like maintenance therapy with a fluoropyrimidine plus bevacizumab. And interestingly, the patient had a continued response. I mean, he even responded even further on this fluoropyrimidine plus bevacizumab. And his tumor marker, CA, just as a marker of overall tumor load, went from 52,000 now sustained to around 8 to 9. And he has excellent performance status. He has absolutely no side effects, no really treatment or tumor-related symptoms right now. So right now, I just saw him in June, CA 8.7, great tolerability. And this is really something which shows the power of the right treatment for the right patient at the right time. And right treatment here was the choice of a triplet and panitumumab in this RAS-RAF wild-type left-sided tumor.
Any comments, Mike, on this case? And also, the I think maybe what I perceive to be some reluctance on the part of oncologists in the United States to use EGFR antibodies, particularly up front. Any thoughts?
You know, I think I would say that, you know, this case for me is one where triplet therapy is just perfect, right? I mean, I think we have clearly consistent data showing that triplet is extremely active and seems to provide better kind of initial kind of response and benefit than doublet therapy. And even potentially in the longer term, you know, kind of trends to improving our kind of overall survival. So I think there's a lot of data supporting a triplet-based approach. I think I would say myself, I do a fair amount of triplet and I often do more anti-VEGF-based therapy such as bevacizumab than I do with kind of anti-GFR-based therapy. And I think there's clearly data out there for, I think, triplet with anti-GFR therapy. I think you are just taking a combination that has more concern for toxicity than anti-GFR, which tends to have a toxicity associated with it, though not necessarily synergistic here we're talking about. But so for me, for this case, I think, you know, the triplet would be the take home for me. I think this is clearly a case where you want to get an immediate response. You need to, you know, you have a liver that's threatened. And so you really have one option to really change the trajectory of this patient's case. And so you have to be kind of aggressive up front. And so I think the question that I think the anti-GFR versus the anti-VEGF, I think, is a little bit based on kind of the patient in regards to potentially tolerance, you know, would be my question there. I don't know, Axel, how often do you do the triplet and EGFR? Is that kind of your normal triplet kind of biologic pairing in the right setting, or are you actually often are doing more an anti-VEGF?
I do more anti-VEGF, you know, you're absolutely right. This was a unique case, but it shows, because I really needed a response. He needed a response. And when you look at the data from the German FOLFI study, we're talking about the rightly selected patient population, FOLFOXIRI plus panitumumab, 90% response rate. I mean, that is colorectal cancer we're talking about, not lymphoma. So that shows you how powerful a regimen can be if we look at the right patient.
So let's talk a little bit about targeted therapy, specifically as it relates to BRAF. And Axel, maybe you can kind of review what we know about BRAF mutations in colorectal cancer.
Yeah, so BRAF mutations actually have two different components. As a prognostic factor, it's really the molecular factor with the poorest prognosis that we have identified, at least before we targeted BRAF. And BRAF mutation come in different classes. Actually, there are three different classes that are being identified. The standard BRAF V600E mutation is the one with the poor prognosis, where we at least, you know, some data that we want to counteract the poor prognosis by being aggressive up front. So, for instance, using FOLFOXIRI, bevacizumab, and non-BRAF V600E mutation, you know, there's a lot of patients that actually have better prognosis. We can consider de-escalation therapy. But it's also a predictive factor and a negative predictive marker for the idea that at least before we had BRAF inhibitors in combination with EGFR antibodies, cetuximab and panitumumab were really not working in this setting. And so BRAF V600E mutation is a negative predictive marker for the use of EGFR antibodies with or without chemotherapy. But on the other hand, once we combine EGFR antibody with a BRAF inhibitor, like has been done in the VIC regimen, so bemrafenib, irinotecan, and cetuximab, or the Beacon doublet or triplet regimen, which we'll probably talk about in a minute, you know, at that point, you know, we can actually utilize BRAF V600 mutation as a predictive marker for the efficacy of this biologically designed targeted approach to inhibit the MAP kinase pathway.
Mike, anything you want to add to that and any comments about what we've learned about the biology here?
I think Axel's exactly right. I mean, it's a robustly prognostic marker. So just knowing that out of the gate is clinically useful. You often do see also a different distribution in metastatic sites, you know, more peritoneal and some unusual locations, you know, brain and bone. So I think it's useful to know that just for kind of understanding the patient's biology in front of you. And I think it's very true. You know, a patient with a BRAF, I tell them a very different story about expectations than I do a patient that does not have a BRAF V600E, just based on that prognostic aspect. And then predictively, yes, we have new targets for it. I still also think it's a negative predictive factor for EGFR, but it's also almost a negative predictive factor for just chemotherapy responsiveness. You know, these tumors just do not have kind of good kind of response to chemotherapy. And we see that probably most dramatically when you look at, you know, giving second line or third line systemic chemotherapy, where their response rates are really, and the PFS are really just horrible. And so it really gets a point where we want to use our best chemotherapy, a triplet up front, and then actually go and move towards targeted based therapy right after that. I mean, I think that's pretty clear in what we need to do in regards to addressing these patients. The only other side, you know, with BRAF, there is an association of BRAF with MSI high, and we'll kind of get to that a little bit later. But clearly, a subset of BRAFs do have an MSI high component. And so clearly, you have two different targets. And I think, you know, from my perspective, I think if you have that situation, often the immune therapy with the outcomes we see there probably would be driving the initial direction of therapy for that type of co-alteration patient.
So Axel, can you talk a little bit about what we've learned in terms of targeted therapy of patients with colorectal cancer and BRAF? It turned out not to be as simple as, for example, melanoma.
That's a very interesting story because melanoma BRAF inhibition works, you know, and BRAF plus MEK inhibition is actually one of the standards of care for the 40% of patients in melanoma with BRAF V600E mutation. But Scott Kopetz actually at MD Anderson did the initial study of you're just using a BRAF inhibitor in BRAF V600E mutant tumors, vemurafenib at that time, and you really didn't see a lot of responses, probably around less than 5%, was very disappointing results, clearly not mirroring what we saw in melanoma. We've learned actually, you know, that the MAP kinase pathway in epithelial cancers, particular colorectal cancer, probably needs to be inhibited in more biologically, let's say, a strategic way, not just using a BRAF inhibitor, but acknowledging that, you know, there's a feedback loop actually that when phospho-ERK as a readout of the pathway actually goes down, that the MAP kinase pathway gets reactivated through, you know, EGF receptor signaling, which identifies actually how important this MAP kinase pathway is for tumor biology because the tumor tries to reactivate the same pathway over and over again. So we have learned actually from very sophisticated translational studies that we need to combine a BRAF inhibitor with an EGF receptor antibody to really shut down or kind of block the MAP kinase pathway, at least for some time, because we know that resistance mechanisms actually evolve quite rapidly. We've also learned that the addition of a MEK inhibitor doesn't really contribute a lot. So right now, the standard of care for these BRAF V600E mutant tumors is a biologic doublet consisting of a BRAF inhibitor like encorafenib and an EGF receptor antibody like cetuximab or panitumumab.
So recently, we saw the results of the Beacon CRC study that randomized patients to receive encorafenib and cetuximab with or without benimetinib, or the old standard of care, which is cetuximab and irinotecan or FOLFIRI. The results showed that the combination of encorafenib and cetuximab with or without benimetinib resulted in significantly longer overall survival. And the response rate was 20% for the doublet, 27% for the triplet, compared to only 2% for the control arm. This study formed the basis of the FDA approval of the combination of encorafenib and cetuximab for patients with metastatic colorectal cancer and a BRAF V600E mutation. So, Mike, can you talk a little bit about how you approach the use of targeted therapy right now outside a trial setting for patients with BRAF mutant disease?
I think the data we've had is really kind of robust. You know, we've seen some of the hazard ratios of just being dramatic in regards to suggesting that clearly using targeted therapy is the approach that we should take. I think the issue that we have to recognize is that we've shown from both the VIC data and the Beacon data is, you know, the control arm, you know, we're looking at, you know, 2 months progression-free survival. And so we are actually, you know, doubling or, you know, even a little bit more improving our disease control, but still, it's fairly limited. I mean, that's the one caveat. I think we clearly have a new direction here, but still, BRAF is a challenging kind of disease state. And so clearly more efforts are needed. And I think moving these drugs, as Axel mentioned earlier, is something we want to actually explore and do and potentially even, you know, frontline combination with therapy or adjuvant. I think in regards to kind of standard of care approach, you know, I think the encorafenib and cetuximab combination is a combination where we see a good safety profile. We have the largest kind of randomized phase 3 study data there. And so for me, that's kind of the de facto standard that I utilize for this patient population in kind of second line space for them. I think the other issue that you have to be aware of in regards to treating the BRAF patient is that, you know, these patients do, you know, they have these worst prognostic outcome. And so you do definitely see this kind of rapid rapidity of growth. And you see rapidity of shrinkage from targeted therapy for the BRAF patients. But then also you do see when they evade that or you develop your adaptive resistance, it often can be very rapid. And so I do think it's very interesting sometimes where you can see rapid changes in regards to treating a BRAF patient that you have to be kind of cautious of. And I think, you know, maybe we can get Axel's opinion on this, given his work kind of with the ANCHOR study, where they had some really interesting data on CEA change in regards to early CEA change and also then kind of RECIST radiographic change, where you actually see very consistently CEA changes happening in almost all patients, yet those appear to be, you know, kind of rapid kind of CEA changes. And then you actually see a number of patients still demonstrating progression when you're kind of looking at your standard kind of 2 month interval, suggesting that there's even a subpopulation that potentially is responding quickly and then adaptively having resistance quickly as a possible kind of explanation for that finding.
So Mike brought up the ANCHOR study that you just presented, Axel. Can you comment on that?
Banker used a biologic triplet combination of the Beacon regimen, which was tested successfully in the second and third line setting, now in the first line setting in BRAF V600 immune tumors. So this was a two-stage design of a single-arm phase two study looking at, you know, 40 patients initially and trying to see whether we could at least achieve a 40% response rate, then expanding the study to a total of 90 plus patients now. And the primary endpoint of response rate was met with about 50% of patients having response. And the response actually came quite rapidly, and the waterfall plot was quite impressive. But as Mike pointed out before, you know, the progression-free survival was not as intriguing as this waterfall plot might suggest, because this waterfall plot really shows that almost every patient really had shrinkage, even patients considered with disease progression, which were off-target lesions. But progression-free survival was only about 4.8 months, so not as strong as, again, this waterfall plot would suggest, in line with the idea that BRAF inhibition, even with encorafenib and cetuximab here, and binimetinib in this biologic triplet, there are resistance mechanisms that evolve quite rapidly. And actually, I do see that in my clinical practice. I just had a patient who had a very dramatic and fast response to the Beacon regimen, actually, in a second-line setting after FOLFOXIRI bevacizumab. But now, today, actually, turned things around, had rapid progression of disease. And what I'm doing right now is actually trying to figure out what's going on using a ctDNA assay to see whether we can identify what is driving this resistance, hoping that I might be able to funnel him into a potential clinical trial.
Mike, any thoughts?
So I think a lot of success in BRAF, right? You know, we should be clear about that. But I also think we have to understand that BRAF intrinsically is a poor prognostic subset. And so even with the successful new targeted therapies we have, it is still a poor prognostic subset. So I think that's just the issue. And so I think, you know, it goes along, we have new treatment options, but also you have to be very cautious with patients saying that the progression-free survival control is still fairly limited. You know, we'd say, as you just heard from Axel talking about, you know, 4 to 5 months for the median. And that potentially when patients do progress, I think very consistently, you often see kind of a rapid progression and often almost more, you know, systemic symptoms of kind of cachexia and just kind of, you know, fatigue that often occur in that context. So I think the critical issue is that, you know, great that we have new therapeutic options, but also remember that you're still dealing with a subset that I think prognostically we should be talking with our patients slightly differently about in regards to expectations and understanding what these very new therapies, the limitations we still see with these very new targeted combinations.
So actually, let's take a look at a couple of cases before we go any farther. Axel, you had, I don't know if this is the patient you were just talking about, this 66-year-old man. Maybe you can kind of go through that case. Is that the patient you were just talking about?
That's actually the patient I was just talking about.
That's what,
right?
I figured. Yeah, but maybe you can go through that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. A very interesting patient because he had a BRAF V600 mutant tumor, right-sided cancer, was initially diagnosed with anemia, you know, workup, it was a CT scan. And he had this different pattern of metastasis that we really see in a lot of patients with BRAF V600 mutant tumors. So peritoneal disease, large lymph nodes, also liver metastasis, but also eventually lung metastasis. He had a bowel obstruction, underwent a right hemicolectomy, clearly poor prognosis cancer just from the number of lymph nodes involved, peritoneal disease and M1C cancer, and our molecular profile identified this V600D mutation, TMB10. And I actually wanted him to get into the ANCHOR study. He didn't qualify due to a low ejection fraction. So I started him on FOLFOXIRI bevacizumab, and he never really responded. He had a rising CA on therapy, had more pain, developed really symptoms from his peritoneal disease and liver metastasis. And then, you know, at some point, you know, we talked about why not use the Beacon triplet. You know, at that time, we had the phase three data. And this interesting thing was he had a clinical response within 2 days. I mean, he told me later, it was remarkable. One day he was sick, the other day he was fine and really tolerated the treatment very well. And consistently here with the clinical response, he actually had CT response and had CA response. Very nice. I mean, going from high levels of CA down to trend toward normalization. But today, you know, we're talking about now July, mid-July 2020. He came, he had a CT scan yesterday and had really rapidly progressive disease. Actually, with some interesting things that 2 or 3 of his liver metastases still shrunk. but the rest of the tumor, including a rapidly evolving left supraclavicular lymph node metastasis, had rapidly progressed. And that's one of the reasons why I tried to figure out what's going on and doing a ctDNA assay right now.
Wow. Mike, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of the BRAF story, with kind of rapid, impressive responses, but potentially kind of more on the short-lived time scale. And then when progression does happen, it often is kind of rapid in response. I think, you know, Axel can talk a little bit more about this, but I think the current, you know, kind of metastatic question that's going to be asked is from the Breakwater study, which is actually exploring kind of the idea of combining BRAF targeted therapy with chemotherapy, potentially really kind of seeing if that combination could help address some of these other kind of challenges we're seeing. So there's going to be a frontline kind of evaluation looking at safety, where you're looking at your combination of encorafenib and cetuximab with either kind of FOLFOX or FOLFIRI to determine tolerance, and then kind of going forward in the larger randomized study to see if that, you know, idea of BRAF targeted therapy plus our kind of classic kind of standard chemotherapy potentially is a way to even get, you know, more success, where we potentially can use chemotherapy to help kind of control some of this rapid resistant clones that potentially are occurring.
Mike, you also had a case. This is a 61-year-old patient. Can you talk about what happened there?
Yeah, so this is a patient that had metastatic adenocarcinoma of the cecum with peritoneal metastases. And so you have your RAS wild type proficient mismatch repair and had a BRAF V600E mutation, and then got standard kind of frontline therapy, FOLFOX bevacizumab, with progression after kind of six cycles. So initial kind of stabilization of disease and then progression. And then we actually initiated on vemurafenib, irinotecan, cetuximab. And I think the issue here is that the patient's best response was progressive disease. You know, I think a lot of times we show cases where the outcome's always kind of, you know, the exception or fantastic. And so I think there are a number of cases where we do see this, right? We see from the comparison of really chemotherapy working at, you know, less than, you know, 5% range, you know, 2%, you know, we heard in regards to the Beacon control arm, you see a marked improvement in that, but still we're talking about response rates that are, you know, well less than kind of, you know, half the population we're treating here. And so in this patient, you know, had extensive peritoneal disease and then just had, you know, robust progression in peritoneal disease following this combination. We subsequently tried to explore potentially a clinical trial, but due to some time in kind of identifying a trial, the patient then had just performance status decline and actually went eventually to hospice care after that kind of two lines of therapy with basically kind of progression through both, which can be what the experience is with BRAF V600E metastatic colorectal cancer.
So, Axel, any final comments about management of patients with BRAF? Any thoughts about using it up front combined with chemo? Any new strategies that have you excited?
So I believe that it's definitely worthwhile testing the biologic combination, you know, in combination with chemotherapy up front. It hopefully will lead to longer lasting responses, which are clinically meaningful for patients. I also believe, you know, that these targeted approaches could be very interesting for the adjuvant setting. And then, of course, with the idea of curing more patients so that they don't even develop the metastasis that we're facing as poor prognosis group of patients. But I also believe we need to work on the resistance mechanisms that evolve, you know, rapidly after, you know, beacon-like treatment approaches. That's definitely an area of unmet need and unmet research need, because, you know, even though I believe, you know, we are doing better now and we've found something interesting to treat our patients, we still need to do better.
Now, I was going to say, I think the one point Axel brought up is great. I think this is one of the spaces where circulating tumor DNA has really been extremely insightful in kind of the research space, because it's really clear that when you look at targeted resistance mechanisms, there are multiple at play. You know, so you have many different clones escaping suppression or control by targeted therapy in many different mechanisms. And so one of the best ways to really assess tumor in totality is looking at the shed kind of tumor DNA through circulating tumor DNA, markedly better than actually a biopsy. And so I think that it's fairly clear now that if you're looking at the question of what is potentially driving resistance here, circulating tumor DNA is the way to go in regards to getting at that.
So let's talk about immunotherapy in colorectal cancer, both MSI high and MSI stable disease. And Axel, maybe you can begin by kind of providing a little bit of an overview of what we know about in terms of the genotype of colorectal cancer as it relates to immunotherapy.
Immunotherapy actually works in immunogenic tumors. You know, and immunogenic tumors are identified by the expression of neoantigens on the surface of these tumor cells. So there are two different ways to generate these neoantigens, you know, on the surface. One is by, you know, being exposed to carcinogenic agents or factors like sun, like smoking, etc. And that's why we see that melanomas and non-small cell lung cancer in general actually do respond to immunotherapy quite well. For colorectal cancer, the situation is a little bit different because right now we have identified these 4 to 5% of patients with metastatic disease that have the mismatch repair deficiency phenotype, meaning they have an inherent tendency to develop these mutations because the mismatch repair enzymes are deficient or not functioning well. And so the tumors accumulate these mutations that can then lead to the expression of these neoantigens on the surface of tumor cells and make these cells immunogenic. This really classifies right now colorectal cancer as one immunogenic tumor with high mutational load, you know, the MSI high tumors, potentially Pol E mutation, you know, which is a smaller group, and then the MSS tumors with low tumor mutational burden that do not respond to conventional immunotherapy approaches right now.
Mike, can you talk a little bit about what we know about the immunotherapy in MSI high disease?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think this has been one of the real kind of dramatic successes we've seen recently. And I think, you know, it's interesting. It is, as Axel described, really kind of a black or white kind of differentiation. You know, we see patients with deficient mismatch repair having really dramatic responses and people with proficient mismatch repair having almost no response. And we can kind of talk about that a little bit more, but it's really clear cut and kind of delineating the population that's responding to immune therapy. And so based on kind of identifying this subpopulation, you know, we've seen a lot of approvals and a lot of, you know, change in regards to practice pattern over the last few years, right? So if you look at metastatic colorectal cancer that's deficient in mismatch repair, we have approvals for pembrolizumab, we have approval for nivolumab, we have approval for nivolumab and ipilimumab in refractory setting. Recently, we have the KEYNOTE-177 study that actually now has gotten an FDA approval for pembrolizumab in the frontline setting for deficient mismatch repair metastatic colorectal cancer. And even pembrolizumab also has an indication for, you know, deficient mismatch repair any solid tumor cancer, right? So the first tumor agnostic indication outside of the colorectal space falls in there. So a number of different indications where we see kind of really robust activity. And I think, you know, the KEYNOTE-177 is kind of the most recent study, a randomized phase 3 study looking at pembrolizumab in the frontline for metastatic colorectal cancer versus chemotherapy. And, you know, the outcomes are just really tremendous. And you see a progression rate that does exist. So there is a rate of patients that have progression, but the vast majority of patients are benefiting. And we see this consistent, you know, plateauing of our progression-free survival curve that's been consistent with all of our immune therapy approaches in deficient mismatch repair colorectal cancer and tumors in general. And so I think that's kind of what's really gotten us exciting. And I think, you know, I participated in a number of the earlier studies looking at nivolumab and nivolumab ipilimumab, and we have patients now that are, you know, 4 years out off therapy and without any disease recurrence. So I really do believe that, you know, in an anecdotal sense, we're clearly seeing this tail of the curve persisting. And clearly there's a subset there that we're curing with immune therapy. There is no doubt about that. And I think that's kind of what's really kind of made this group so exciting is that, you know, yes, a therapy that works very well, but a therapy that's really just a game changer for patients, right? I mean, I think historically we would say metastatic colorectal cancer, you know, outside of surgical intervention, we are palliating, we are going to extend your life, but we're not going to fix it. But identifying, you know, deficient mismatch repair subset is a group where you can say immune therapy works well, we potentially are fixing and curing your problem. And I really think that is kind of a game changer in perspective. I think the challenge, as Axel mentioned, is that in the metastatic space, we're talking about, you know, 4 to 5% of patients, right? So 1 in 20 patients have this, and the vast majority of patients you see do not have this. But I think that the success and activity here just makes the point that it is imperative that we test and identify these patients. I mean, it works that well. And so I think that really gets to the initial kind of testing needs to be done. And that can be easily by immunohistochemical staining, which is fairly simple and easy. And any local lab can do that. And I think that's a fine approach to do it. Or you can have it incorporated into a, you know, a larger next generation sequencing panel. And that would be a fine approach to capture these patients. But it's really critical that we do capture these patients. And now, you know, as I just said, we can capture them and give them this pembrolizumab in the very front line with metastatic disease, which is fantastic. On this slide here, you're seeing kind of the outcomes reported. You know, for me, we do see the stable disease potentially having real benefits. So it is kind of the disease control rate, which I think is the real potential rate that is demonstrating the beneficial rate in regards to kind of immune therapy response. But the one noted here from a slide is the rate of progressive disease, which is higher in immune therapy. So the one challenge we do have in immune therapy, and one of the areas that I think is probably the most interesting and current ongoing research efforts, is that progressive disease does occur, and it tends to most commonly be, you know, kind of intrinsic or innate progression. So we see adaptive resistance rarely, but most commonly you see that upfront subset. So there's a subset of deficient mismatch repair, colorectal cancer, deficient mismatch repair, any tumor type that has progression to immune therapy. So that's approximately about 30% of patients with monotherapy, PD-1 based therapy, consistently seen across all different data sets. And so, you know, who are those patients? We can talk about what we don't really quite yet know who those patients are. There is some data with combination that potentially maybe does seem to have a lower rate of progression. So potentially, you know, combination therapy addresses some of that concern over the progression rate, but with the cost of the toxicity of having to use dual kind of immune therapy agents, which is your anti-PD-1 and your anti-CTLA-4.
So Axel, any comments about that? And from a clinical point of view, the fact that you see this progression, what does that mean? For example, if you have a symptomatic patient, would you still go with PD-1? And also, as we look at this slide here, looking at ipi/nivo, any thoughts about that as well? It looks like the rate of progression, at least indirectly, seems smaller. But any thoughts, Axel?
Yeah, I think it is a clinically important point that there is a group of patients, about 30%, that have progression as their best response, in spite of the fact that they have mismatch repair deficient MSI high tumors. And it will be critical for us to identify these patients. And I do believe, you know, there are some, you know, we could potentially look at tumor mutational burden, you know, which is a surrogate marker for the responsiveness, even of MSI high tumors, for two immunotherapies, because we know that in the MSI high group, high TMB, let's say over 20, over 30, predicts for a good response, whereas lower TMB, and these tumors exist actually, MSI high, lower TMB, below 20, they do not have the same level of response. And it could well be that we might have to combine these PD-1 antibody pembrolizumab with chemotherapy upfront, and then potentially use pembrolizumab as maintenance therapy. Because, you know, the intriguing part, as Mike pointed out, is really the plateau. And I strongly believe there are patients with mismatch repair deficient metastatic colon cancer that can be cured with single agent or combination of immunotherapy. The nivo-ipi data are interesting, but admittedly, you know, this is not a randomized comparison. It's 45 patients presented by Heinz Lenz repeatedly now. But the one interesting point was that with the longer follow-up that Heinz Lenz showed, the depth of response seemed to be stronger. And as you alluded to, at least numerically, the number of patients progressing was lower. So it could well be that the pembrolizumab single agent approval just opens the door for future combinations and future assessment, you know, which patient needs pembro alone, which patients needs it in combination with chemotherapy or potentially with a CTLA-4 antibody or other immune therapies.
So we'll present a couple of cases, but Mike, I also want to ask you about, I heard about this marker POLE or POLE. Can you comment a little bit on that and kind of how that fits into this puzzle?
Yeah, so polymerase epsilon and polymerase delta are kind of proteins, genes involved in kind of DNA replication. And so if you look at microsatellite stable colorectal cancer, you will see some patients that have a very high tumor mutation burden. And so when you look at those patients, very frequently what you see is a polymerase epsilon and polymerase delta kind of mutation. And so clearly we see this across a number of tumor types. This often happens in GBM-based patients where you see kind of a high rate of a polymerase epsilon, and you can see these patients, kind of young patients with this. And it's consistently shown to have a high tumor mutation burden. Now, the key kind of issue to note here is that polymerase epsilon is a very large gene, so you can have many mutations in it that are not functional. So we're really talking about functional polymerase epsilon mutations, which some recent data at ASCO presented by Timothy Yap showed that, you know, the rate of mutations in polymerase epsilon that are functional is actually approximately, you know, about 20% or so. And so the vast majority of mutations are not functional. And so we're really caring about the functional mutations that result in kind of errors in DNA replication that result in high mutation load, right? So that's your classic functional polymerase epsilon should have a high mutation load, and they get very high mutation loads. And so clearly, anecdotally, we've seen immune responses in these patients. Now, these are very rare, even more rare than we just talked about in regards to kind of deficient mismatch repair. You see them more commonly, again, in earlier stage disease, and very rare as you become more metastatic, which is a very similar story to what we see with deficient mismatch repair, suggesting you have some immune surveillance that's preventing them from kind of becoming, developing metastatic sites. But I do think it is a population to potentially recognize and would be one that would make a lot of sense for kind of immune therapy. And I think if we kind of put the polymerase epsilon in the context of kind of this recent kind of tumor agnostic indication for pembrolizumab with patients with a tumor mutation burden greater than 10, that's kind of for all tumor types. So a very recent tumor agnostic indication based on TMB. You can see these patients with a functional polymerase epsilon will always have a TMB greater than 10. So I think there is that avenue now to kind of get these patients immune therapy. And so from my view, that is a group that we do look for, though I would say it is, you were talking probably in the metastatic space, the less than 1% kind of space or numbers in regards to finding these patients. But clearly, if you found a functional polymerase, I think immune therapy would be the recommendation from me in regards to kind of the approach. And with this tumor agnostic indication, you can actually now do that as a standard of care practice.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up that indication because I've been asking people on a variety of tumor types, Mike, kind of where it fits in or, you know, what it actually means clinically, what kind of situations. It was 10, which is not that high. Can you describe a clinical situation where you think this would apply, Mike? Would it be like rare tumors or where would you use this?
Yeah, we can have an interesting discussion on this point because the FDA gave this approval. If you look at the FDA label, you don't see any common tumor types. It's a number of rare tumor types that demonstrated a high TMB with improved kind of clinical outcomes. And the challenge that I have here is that unlike deficient mismatch repair, which is really kind of a fundamental, consistent alteration that leads to a really expected kind of outcome, irrespective of tumor histology, TMB is often very tumor histology dependent. You know, the reason for having a tumor mutation burden high is very dependent on the tumor type and what the carcinogenic exposure or kind of the development of that tumor is. And so there's a lot more, I think, inconsistency when you think about applying this across various different tumor histology and tumor types. And so we can kind of come back to colorectal cancer, but there were no colorectal cancer patients in the FDA label for this approval. And if you actually go into the colorectal cancer space and say, well, what is the experience with immune therapy in patients that have, you know, a high TMB? And those studies have been done. And the experience is the response rates are dismal. You know, less than 5% space is what you see. It's not what's kind of seen from the FDA label that got the approval, which is more kind of around 30% kind of response rates. And so what I would say, Neil, is that, you know, the population that I think is the potential driver. What is that rare population? The polymerase epsilon is clearly one of the more common ones. There was a recent kind of TMB evaluation from the TRIBE2 study that was presented at ASCO and ESMO that looked at TMB in that kind of study population and actually found high TMBs in the microsatellite stable population. But I think the vast majority of them were polymerase epsilon driven. And so from my take, my recommendation is I think unless you have a driver polymerase epsilon mutation for microsatellite stable colorectal cancer with a TMB greater than 10, I think the chance of activity is markedly lower than what we see with the FDA label. And so I think that has to be the real kind of understanding of providers and patients in regards to kind of potentially engaging on that label. And I would say, you know, from my view, I think, you know, the rare tumor type where we have less understanding, we don't have the studies to kind of tell us what the real expectation is. I think there's rationale and it makes sense. But I think in a common tumor type where we have the data that gives us the answer, I don't necessarily agree with this kind of tumor agnostic indication would be kind of my general sense.
So Axel, one of the things I was thinking about is, you know, almost every cancer, when you have a patient is in good condition with metastatic disease or runs out of options, people think about checkpoint inhibitors, even if there's no data. And, you know, you can understand clinically why they might want to think about it, although there's also the toxicity. I was thinking that this indication might actually make it easier for, you know, a doc to do that outside of, you know, if they happen to have a high TMB, but I couldn't really figure out what this is all about. Axel, any thoughts?
Yeah, you know, I couldn't figure it out either, you know, because I completely agree with what Mike said. And I've outed myself as a critiquer of the FDA approval on Twitter, you know, which is the most important medical education forum right now outside of research to practice. So this is, I did not really fully understand why the FDA went kind of overboard with this very broad approval because, you know, as you said, you know, people will try it. People will use, everyone wants immunotherapy. And I've seen so many patients with a TMB of 10. It's 10 plus, so 10 is included. Yeah. And it is really common. And I'm worried that patients will be misled in a way and providers will be misled. And, you know, if a patient sits in front of me and says, I want immunotherapy because it's an approved agent, it's hard to take a stand and say, you know, financial toxicity, clinical toxicity, and, you know, perhaps not going into a clinical trial or using standard treatment options. I mean, it's not that regorafenib and TAS-102 are really complete game changers, but they have activity. They have phase 3 data that are clearly more robust in colorectal cancer than in the TMB-10 pembrolizumab treatment approaches.
So we'll see where that leads. But just to finish out this discussion, let's hear about a case. And Axel, you had this 40-year-old patient. Can you comment on what happened there?
Yeah, that was an interesting case, you know, where I started to learn a little bit more about, you know, checkpoint inhibitors and MSI-high tumors. This was a patient, actually, when I was at Mayo Clinic, who had a liver metastasis from a sigmoid cancer. It was actually a Lynch patient. This patient defined actually the whole family as a Lynch family, so it was clearly very important for him to know that. They initially had FOLFOX neoadjuvant indication because the idea was to resect his liver metastasis. And he was treated outside initially, but he developed actually abscesses in his liver, had repeated septic episodes, and came to Mayo after he'd received a cycle of FOLFIRI, you know, as a second-line therapy because, you know, the liver metastasis did not respond to FOLFOX. So he came to see me, and this is actually the first patient where I used pembrolizumab in a neoadjuvant indication in this setting, which 3 years ago seems like a world ago. So he actually had a nice response, excellent tolerability of the treatment. And, you know, the immune therapy was also important because he had these repeated septic episodes on chemotherapy and with the liver metastasis. He eventually, you know, went resection of his sigmoid cancer and the liver metastasis. And, you know, both areas had actually a complete pathologic CR. So we still saw some spots, you know, some lesions on the MRI. But, you know, upon a pathologic review, all these lesions were, you know, didn't have vital tissue anymore. So he was then followed and moved away from Mayo Clinic. But what I learned here is neoadjuvant checkpoint inhibitors can work in MSI-high tumors, number one. Number two, we probably underestimate the completeness of the response from a pathologic level because we might still have some residual scar lesions that it might see those scar lesions present after immune checkpoint inhibitors. But, you know, we hardly ever go after all these lesions to resect them. This is actually something that I've talked to Scott Kopetz about, and I know there are some MD Anderson experience exactly in the same way. So we are underappreciating the completeness and the robustness of the response on checkpoint inhibitors sometimes.
So, Mike, two questions. One, are there situations where you would consider ipi-nivo in a patient with MSI-high disease as the primary form of immunotherapy? And secondly, any clues in terms of MS-stable disease that have you excited, Mike?
So I think that is a real clinical question, right? I think, you know, we don't have an approval for nivolumab, ipilimumab in the front line. So that's kind of the one key question or point that needs to be made here. We're really talking probably the approvals are really kind of more second and more third line, but guidelines kind of allow it in a second line setting. And so in that second line setting, yeah, I think you have the monotherapy or the combination therapy question. I think, you know, cross-trial comparisons, you do seem to have less progression and potentially a higher PFS when you look at combination of nivolumab, ipilimumab. And you showed earlier the 45-patient frontline study, but there's a 100-patient refractory setting that led to the approval that is very, very similar. So kind of two consistent data sets where you do see potentially, I think, you know, this consistency of kind of PFS and response rate and lower progressive disease rate, which is kind of more around 10%. Whereas when you see consistently across, you know, PD-1 therapies, you see a PD rate of 30%. And so I do think it really raises the question. And I think, you know, the perspective here a little bit, I think two points is one, you know, if the goal is curability, then I think it does raise the question of combination therapy because, you know, we do a lot when we think about trying to cure somebody. And so I think that is the real rationale that would drive one to a combination-based approach. The frontline nivolumab, ipilimumab cohort from CheckMate 142 actually utilized an ipilimumab every 6-week dosing, which appeared to kind of improve tolerance. That's actually been seen in other tumor types as well. So potentially addressing some of the concerns with combination. But I think that's the real rationale. I think the unknown question is the question of whether you can do monotherapy with PD-1 and then follow it up with combination therapy. And so that's kind of the real question. Could combination therapy following monotherapy be active in regards
you're talking
to
about a patient,
you,
you're talking about a patient with progression on single agent?
Progressed, correct, exactly, yeah. So you have a patient who progresses on therapy because the question, most patients don't progress, right? So could you actually salvage patients with combination? Is that the best way to apply who the combination patient should be applied to? And we just don't have data in deficient mismatch repair about that, right? And melanoma does have some data. So in melanoma space, there is some anecdotal data that applying combination anti-CTLA-4 and pembrolizumab after PD-1 progression does appear to have activity. Anecdotally, we've seen that in deficient mismatch repair, where I've seen anecdotal cases where you have combination therapy can work in patients that have PD-1 progression. And so the question is that a value, you know, kind of an option or algorithm that would be possible and apply? And I think we just don't really have yet the knowledge to know how well that would work in regards to kind of a mono into combo kind of strategy versus the question of mono versus combo up front. And so at the end of the day, I think, Neil, the real question is really, I think a lot comes back to comfortability from the practice perspective. You know, there is more immune toxicity with combination. I think you have to have a structure where you're comfortable with that, you're able to engage upon that and recognize that, because those toxicities can be real severe. And I think both are really reasonable approaches at this time. There is an ongoing clinical trial that's looking at this question, which you just got at, which is the question of monotherapy versus combo therapy in metastatic deficient mismatch repair colorectal cancer. So I think in time, we will have some more data to kind of answer that question. You know, the microsatellite stable space is a space that's been challenging. I think there has been some pilot kind of efforts, which is one is shown here, looking at the combination of regorafenib and nivolumab from a Japanese group that really showed, you know, robust kind of activity. I think the challenge and the question right now is just confirming this in a separate data set. And that's where we have actually had some challenges. So there's been some clinical trial that came out of Moffitt that actually looked at this combination and actually did not see any responders in a smaller kind of sample set size. And then we actually see a combination that was looking at another kind of PD-1 with regorafenib that saw a much lower rate of kind of response and retrospective data sets that haven't replicated that level of response. So I think there's a lot of interest in that combination, but I also think the validation cohorts that have come out so far have been fairly small, but have not seen the level of activity that we see there. And so I think that for me is a combination that's still really under exploration and one that I do not now kind of recommend. I really think clinical trials is still the approach in regards to when people ask me about immune therapy for microsatellite stable colorectal cancer. I really discuss the fact that we don't know what the right approach is. And I think there's a number of approaches under investigation. There's a number of studies looking at novel combinations. And I really think doing that under a clinical trial kind of approach is really the best way forward right now, though I do think, you know, we have vaccines, we have CAR-Ts, we have BiTE kind of targeting combination antibodies. And so there are a lot of interesting approaches, but I think, you know, we're still kind of early in knowing which one is going to be the successful approach for us that's going to lead to an indication or a change in therapy for microsatellite stable colorectal cancer for immune therapy.
We have seen, Mike, some encouraging data combining anti-angiogenic strategies in HCC. Right now, atezolizumab, that same lenvatinib pembro and microsatellite stable endometrial cancer, first-line therapy, renal cell. Any thoughts about that strategy in MS-stable disease and colorectal cancer, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, so regorafenib is, you know, an anti-VEGF targeting agent. It has some other effects as well. I think the challenge, and I think, you know, Axel can talk about this too, but well, we've done a study looking at, you know, VEGF targeting therapy with, you know, kind of atezolizumab. So a PD-L1 with, you know, the combination of an anti-VEGF antibody and did not see a positive signal there. in a clinical trial. And then we've also looked at kind of monotherapy. You know, there was a prior kind of effort looking at cobimetinib, which was kind of a very exciting kind of effort that was looked at cobimetinib and atezolizumab. And so I agree with you. There's a lot of different tumor types where we've seen VEGF additive benefits in regards to immune therapy. And clearly VEGF is a major player in immune resistance. I think there's no doubt about that. I think that the challenge in microsatellite stable is that our intrinsic immune response is so low, I'm not sure that fixing that resistance mechanism seems to matter, you know, is kind of the challenge. And I think the regorafenib nivolumab data, you know, it's not clear that it's a VEGF-driven effect in regards to why we're seeing that kind of level of activity, which again, I would reset and say it appears to be much lower than that initial Japanese trial that we just showed.
Yeah, I've had some interesting conversations with your colleague in lung cancer at MD Anderson, John Haymock, talking about angiogenesis as it ties into the immune system. Let's talk a little bit about the use of post-chemotherapy treatment, particularly as it relates to regorafenib and TAS-102. And Axel, maybe you can kind of talk a little bit about sort of how we approach the integration of these agents into the sequence.
Yeah. Let me make one comment with regard to what we just talked about, regorafenib plus PD-1 antibody therapy. I think, and you pointed this out, the lenvatinib pembrolizumab data in MSS endometrial cancer, very intriguing. The data that we saw with this combination in other cancers are very intriguing. There's a basket study right now, the LEAP-005 study, which also includes patients with colon cancer. So we'll get some data. I do believe that in the MSS tumors, VEGF inhibition is needed, but something else, you know, plus PD-1 or PD-L1 antibody. So I do believe, I'm hopeful we're going to get there and really figure out what's going on. It's not going to be just VEGF. It's going to be a signature effect beyond the VEGF inhibition, but I'm hopeful that at some point we'll get there. Now, talking about regorafenib and TAS-102 as a later line therapy, I think we all acknowledge, you know, the standards of care right now is to really expose all patients to all active agents. And it really depends on how we start in terms of molecular profile. But in the end, if we talk about the chemotherapy backbone, it's something like FOLFOX followed by FOLFIRI or FOLFIRI followed by FOLFOX, or using a triplet upfront in certain indications. And then you come to a kind of a commonly third-line setting, and then you have two drugs like regorafenib and TAS-102, which are both oral agents and available for your treatment choice. And they have very similar activity in terms of the trial data that we saw compared to placebo, but they have very different toxicity profiles. And TAS-102, mainly neutropenia, regorafenib, and mainly subjective hand-foot-skin reaction, fatigue, etc. The data that we saw in the randomized trials show there's a real benefit in terms of prolonging survival, mainly due to delaying progression. So these agents, TAS and regorafenib, are both not able to really induce a lot of responses, but they delay progression of tumors. And that is really what is driving the survival difference here. Now, regorafenib, as I mentioned, you know, the main problem that regorafenib has, it's the subjective side effects that patients feel, hand-foot-skin reaction, fatigue, some diarrhea, voice changes. And those actually we know can come early in the treatment of patients. So within the first week or so, especially when we use a high dose, meaning the old standard dose of 160 milligrams per day, which was the standard dose in the registration studies. And so it's an early side effect profile, early AEs that come up. And that's why it was important for us to develop dose mitigation strategies that really take the first 2 weeks into account when patients have the highest likelihood to develop the worst side effect that they'll ever have. And that's why we, you know, also designed a randomized trial together with Tony Saab in order to really see whether we can modify the dosing schema of regorafenib, the so-called REDOS study, which started with half the dose per day in the first week, then escalated the dose from week to week with close monitoring of patients and randomization compared to the standard dosing, which is kind of the high dose or higher dose, 160 milligrams per day as a starting dose, and then really reacting and de-escalating over time. Primary endpoint of the study, I think, was important because we needed to make sure that with a lower starting dose did not compromise the efficacy of this treatment. So the endpoint of the study was how many patients will be able to go beyond the first scan and start cycle 3, because we normally do a scan after cycle 2. So patients would only go to cycle three if they have, number one, tolerated the treatment and were willing to continue. Number two, had at least stable disease on their scans. And lo and behold, you know, the escalating dosing strategies showed a statistically significant and I think clinically meaningful improvement in the numbers of patients that actually went to cycle number three. And in the paper that Tony published about a year ago, we actually showed every single patient in a kind of a heat plot or a heat map, you know, in terms of the dosing strategy that patients went through. And you can see the variability of patients, you know, dosing strategies going up and down, you know, week by week. But eventually it's important for a cytostatic agent like regorafenib to be kept on therapy because cytostatic agents, the efficacy depends on duration of therapy. And that's why kind of allowing patients to stay on therapy longer really drove the benefit of patient that we saw here on regorafenib.
Any comments about the issue of patient selection for regorafenib, Axel?
Very clear that patient with a poor performance status, and I say poor performance status, it's a two and higher, should not be treated with regorafenib. So not every patient will be a candidate for regorafenib. These patients need to be able to understand also about side effect management. They need to be compliant enough to really come for, you know, checkups and perhaps nowadays with telemedicine after a week and so when we check on them. So it really requires an interaction between providers and patients, you know, to be able to really, especially in the first one or two cycles, to make this work. So very clear, patients with poor performance status, heavily pre-treated patients, where those patients should not be treated with regorafenib. It's not a drug that can take patients off a deathbed. You know, there's no Lazarus effect with regorafenib. That is something which I think, you know, has initially compromised the perception of this drug in a lot of people because, you know, patients with poor performance status, they just wanted one additional treatment option, were treated with regorafenib. And in those patients, it really does not work.
Mike, any comments about your clinical experience with regorafenib? In a second, Axel is going to present a case. Have you found it to be useful? How do you approach dosing, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, I think what Axel just demonstrated is really the key is the acknowledgement that, you know, a ramp up dosing approach lets you get to identified dose for a patient that is markedly more tolerable. There are clearly patients that do not tolerate full dose of regorafenib and they can have severe kind of toxicity. And so I think this mechanism, this approach really kind of allows you to kind of get to the right dose for the right patient. And clearly we're talking about, you know, refractory metastatic colorectal cancer, where one of the key goals that we're trying to employ here with our patients is really quality of life, right? So I think this really aligns well with kind of what our goal is. And I think it allows us to give the therapy and the tolerability is markedly more as shown kind of from the redose clinical trial. And so I think that's the right approach. And I think it really does make a difference and it aligns with kind of what our therapeutic and our kind of treatment goals are with patients. And I think Axel is very correct in noting that I think we also have to have kind of a real honest discussion about performance status with patients, because I think there is some potential kind of challenge of, you know, it's an oral pill. It's to some degree, oral pill is a little bit simpler, a little bit easier from a patient's perspective. That seems like kind of, you know, oh, that I can do that. But in patients with that poor PS, you really have to have the honest discussion about what's driving that poor performance status and either get at it and improve it or have the realization that this could really be something where you want to talk about supportive care and kind of end of life management.
So, Axel, I'm curious about this case. I know this is a patient you saw previously, but I've been hearing about this phenomena on and off for years from you. Eric Van Cutsem also mentioned this to me, of cavitation that occurs in patients on anti-angiogenics. And I was interested to see you actually have a case where you have some images. Any comment on this young patient?
This was the typical patient who kind of went through two lines of therapy, had a KRAS mutant tumor and went through FOLFOX-BEV and then FOLFIRI-BEV with some, you know, response initially, but eventually was treated with regorafenib. And after the CORREX trial was closed, I actually never started a patient with 160 milligrams. So I'd been using this redose approach for quite some time. And, you know, it's interesting, you know, this patient had lung metastasis, which were actually one of the dominating part of the disease. And you can easily see the cavitation that happened on regorafenib, which is quite impressive. So this is, interestingly, when you measure this, it's stable disease because the outer contour has not changed. So you measure it and it's stable. But you know that a lot of this tumor has actually been, you know, resolved, you know, and really kind of coughed out more or less, I believe, because, you know, this tumor apparently had access to the airways. And we have known this phenomenon to be this cavitation of lung metastasis to be associated with better outcomes for patients, even when they don't only have lung metastasis, but also liver metastasis. So it shows something about the biologic activity in these patients. And this has been confirmed anecdotally and in actually retrospective analysis of the randomized trials.
So we're going to bring in also the issue of TAS 102. And Mike, you know, one of the common questions we ask is, how do you sequence these agents? TAS 102 is not known to have some of the quality of life issues, more neutropenia, but do you see benefit in this situation? This is a slide that Axel put together with his point of view, but I'm curious, Mike, do you end up using both of these agents in most patients? And how do you decide which one to go with first?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a real, you know, honest clinical question that practitioners are facing in this setting after you kind of go through your classic more chemotherapy and targeted therapy for various different molecular subsets. You're kind of left with really, you know, TAS 102 and regorafenib as your treatment options. And, you know, cross-trial comparisons put them very similar in regards to the efficacy space. You do see differences in regards to safety profiles. And so that's really the difference that does exist. I will say, I think you see in practice a more common utilization of TAS 102 as kind of the initial agent followed by regorafenib. And I would say that's kind of the option I often go to in some sense. You know, I think both are fine to start one or the other in regards to sequencing. I think ideally you'd like to get through both. I think there's some good data that Axel's presented before by, you know, totality of therapy, you know, has improved overall outcomes for patients. And so I think the issue there is just performance status reevaluation after that initial TAS 102 or regorafenib and then assessing, you know, for the alternative one. I do think with the redose approach for regorafenib that actually addresses some of the initial concerns that came out with toxicity. But I do think it is a valid point, you know, that you kind of got at that, you know, blood count are not something that patients necessarily notice. Patients do notice, you know, fatigue and hand-foot syndrome. And so there is a difference in the profile. And I think that probably does tend to kind of lead the choice for TAS 102 in regards to kind of being an initial therapy for patients. I've always wondered, you know, how does prior anti-angiogenic response or benefit potentially, should that influence our decision-making at this point? You know, regorafenib clearly is an agent that's kind of in the anti-VEGF space. And so should prior kind of benefit as best we can, like, glean that out from radiographic or just treatment responses lead to a decision-making difference here? But I think fundamentally, we don't really have good data to say which therapy is better in which patient. And so I really think it is kind of up to that safety discussion with the patient in regards to which agent to utilize first.
So Axel, you had this slide that kind of compares indirectly the data with these two agents. Can you comment on that and sort of where that leads you in terms of sequencing?
Yeah, that is interesting slide because it really looks at the all the phase 3 level of evidence when regorafenib and TAS were compared to placebo in a different patient population. CORRECT and RECOURSE were conducted in more Western patient population plus Japan, and CONCOR and TERRA were in an Asian patient population less heavily pretreated. And that's an interesting phenomenon that we've seen actually consistently, that regorafenib actually seems to have a greater benefit for patients who are less heavily pretreated, whereas TAS 102 seems to be like working in actually quite well in patients who have even in heavily pretreated patients. Interestingly, when you compare the CONCOR versus TERRA results, and here we're talking about cross-trial comparison, it's all taken with a grain of salt, and look at the hazard ratios for overall survival, TERRA Asian patients not as heavily pretreated, hazard ratio 0.79. CONCOR Asian patients not as heavily pretreated for regorafenib, hazard ratio 0.55. So there could be something in this cross-trial comparison that makes more the point of regorafenib going before TAS, with the idea that eventually, as Mike said, we want to use all active agents in all patients. Now, I would clearly say that I do believe that a patient with PS2, well, I would use TAS, but I would not use regorafenib. I think the pool of patients that are candidates for treatment are larger for TAS than for regorafenib, because, you know, as Mike said, you know, it's not as subjectively, you know, interfering with patients' quality of life, certain neutropenia. Now, having said that, you know, we just saw a discussion actually from ESMO and NCCN guidelines about COVID, you know, time, you know, is neutropenia the side effect we like to see, or is a non-chemotherapy agent in a later line setting the one that is appropriate right now? And these are ongoing discussions. Eventually, you know, really have to talk to patients and make a shared decision with them. And also recognizing, you know, that these both drugs are not home runs. You know, they might improve outcomes incrementally. Having the way I actually talk to my patients about these agents, and this is true for regorafenib and for TAS-102, when you look at the analysis of the pivotal trials. So when we do a scan after 2 months of regorafenib, for instance, there's about a 45 to 50% chance patients do not have progression of disease. And if those patients who don't have progression of disease, they have a 50% chance to be alive at 1 year. And that is, I think, something we can explain to patients in terms of, you know, what they can expect. So it's a time-dependent and, you know, a scan-dependent biomarker approach to say, you know, this is what your outcome can be. I normally tell patients, you know, if you want to not miss the opportunity, let's do these 2 months of treatment, let's get a scan, and then we see which group you belong to. Because a year, you know, the chance of having another year is actually clinically meaningful, I think, for patients.
So actually, I want to finish out in a few minutes and talk about the management of HER2 amplified or amplified metastatic disease. But actually, I just saw this case in your deck, Axel, that I wanted to ask you about. We were talking about Rego-Nivo sounding a little bit on the downside, but this sounds pretty interesting. What happened with this patient?
That's an interesting patient. Actually came to me from Florida for a second opinion here to Germantown, Tennessee. And this patient, yeah, very unique situation, and she's very engaged in her care, has probably had biopsies and has molecular profiles repeatedly over the course of her history. So apparently pretty good prognosis group of tumor, because she was initially diagnosed in 2014 and is still actually alive and in excellent performance status. She has a background of Crohn's disease and was diagnosed with an adenocarcinoma in this sigmoid jejunal pouch area, had synchronous liver metastasis, underwent neoadjuvant FOLFOX, and then had a right hepatectomy, classified the tumor as a KRAS G12D mutation, MSS. Yeah, the tumor mutation burden of 15, which gets into the area of being more interesting along the discussion what we talked about, then developed actually more pulmonary lesion. This became that her dominating side of disease about a little bit more than a year later, and then was treated with FOLFIRI bevacizumab, had a response, a treatment break, you know, because she was exhausted from therapy. Then had when she had progression of disease again to FOLFOX bevacizumab, again, worked for some time, progression of disease. TAS-102 didn't do a lot, you know, she had progression of disease right up front, went back to FOLFIRI, so re-exposure to a treatment that she had not progressed on, stable disease, then progression. Then she received pembrolizumab off-label, which we now would actually now be on label with a TMB of 15, which was a foundation assay, had a mixed response, but, you know, rising CA. So I think overall the trend went actually in the wrong direction, and then had clear progression of disease in December, January, just about half a year ago, and then started regorafenib nivolumab. And the interesting thing is I saw the scans, I looked at it, and that's why she came to get my opinion about that. She had a rapid and notable response in the lung metastasis. Again, cavitation, CA went down, et cetera. And when I saw her in June, this response was still sustained. Excellent tolerability, 80 milligrams of regorafenib and a standard dose of 240 milligrams of nivolumab. So the interesting thing was here that she had progression of disease in pembrolizumab and then continued PD-1 inhibition now with nivolumab in addition of regorafenib, a notable response. Longer than I would have expected and stronger than I would have expected with regorafenib, a single agent. Let me add one more point to that. The Japanese study that we looked at before, the phase 1b study that created a lot of interest, Rego-Nivo, a lot of these patients are rectal cancer patients with lung metastasis. And I think this is something we have to recognize, that the Rego-Nivo combination, the immune augmentation approaches, might work in different locations for different metastases in different ways. We know that the immune environment in lung tissue is different than in liver tissue or peritoneal disease, and I would really like to get Mike's opinion about that, whether this is something that he finds is one of those valid approaches, you know, that location of disease might actually predict whether immune system can respond to tumors or not.
Before Mike answers, I'm just kind of curious, why was the patient seeing you, Axel, whether to continue therapy or just out of curiosity or what?
I think it was just curiosity also to showcase herself. I mean, people, you know, there's a whole community of patients, you know, on Twitter and in Colon Town, you know, on Facebook and whatever. So they do interact and they say, hey, there's this guy who's worked with regorafenib and it might have an opinion, you know, what should we do, whatever. And that's why she came.
Really interesting.
Not everyone has to go to MD Anderson for a second opinion. You know, that's
pretty... Well, we can get that second opinion right now. But it is interesting that this patient had cavitation, just like your other patient that you presented with just got regorafenib, right? Mike, any thoughts about this case and what's going on here?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, as Axel stated, the regorafenib and nivolumab data when it first came out was really exciting. And I do want to say that I think there are still patients that respond to it. I think, you know, anecdotally, I've seen it. We just kind of saw a case here. And so I do think there is something to that combination. I just think we have to be very cautious that likely it looks like with the small kind of subsequent validation data sets that benefit rate is much lower than what was initially portrayed. And so what Axel is getting at is the critical question, you know, why are we seeing that kind of discrepancy, right? So clearly there still appears to be some level of activity. We need some larger data sets to really understand that and how to kind of put that into perspective. But there does seem to be a difference between the Japanese data set and kind of the replication kind of smaller data sets. And so why is that their difference? You know, is it kind of a population related difference, you know, a Japanese patient cohort versus here in regards to different HLAs? You know, there's a lot of uncertainty. I do think the idea of different metastatic locations is a really interesting one. I would have to say I don't at present know, you know, in regards to that. I think we'd have to kind of get some more data to kind of see what's necessarily driving that. But there does appear to be a clear question in regards to kind of can we hopefully identify which subgroup potentially is the one that would get us back to that level of the original kind of regorafenib nivolumab activity level and really then be selecting that population for this therapy. And whether that's different, you know, disease biology, pace of biology, or metastatic locations, I think the hope is with time, as we see more patients receiving this type of combination, we'll get a better sense of that, is my hope. And we're having that. There's many ongoing studies with more enrollment to really kind of better delineate kind of what we see in regards to the use of regorafenib and nivolumab across many more patients.
So I'm kind of flashing back to the old days of 2019 when we went to the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium last December and heard a lot about trastuzumab deratuxan. And now in the last few weeks, we're starting to hear about it outside of breast cancer, lung cancer, colorectal and gastric cancer. Mike, can you comment a little bit on what was presented at ASCO? Really fascinating, this DESTINY trial looking at this antibody drug conjugate.
So this is looking at, as you said, trastuzumab deratuxan, which is a new kind of targeted therapy combining a drug bringing in a toxic load to your HER2 kind of a site of expression. And so we've seen activity in breast cancer. And this was basically the fundamental study looking at a specific colorectal cancer population and stratifying that by kind of positivity in regards to kind of HER2 and amplification status. And so you can see here what we're going to see is that the group that really demonstrated the benefit here is the HER2 amplified or the HER2, you know, 3+ kind of population, which is a surrogate for kind of amplification. And so patients with a high level of HER2 are really in the colorectal space, the group that's benefiting, which is a little different from what we see in breast cancer, where we see actually activity kind of across kind of more of a broad HER2 spectrum. I think the real exciting things is that within the HER2 amplified space, we see activity in patients that have had prior HER2 therapy. So that's one kind of point. And then we see a really high level of activity, right? We just saw there a 45% response rate. And you see here the waterfall plot really demonstrating remarkable activity, you know, more than what we've seen kind of with prior HER2 kind of doublet targeting. And these are patients, a number of these that already had prior HER2 therapy. So a really active HER2 targeting agent. I think the one other caveat is what was just kind of shown there in regards to the toxicity spectrum is that there is this unique interstitial lung disease that can happen with this agent and can actually lead to kind of severe kind of lung compromise and even death, as you can see here, kind of 2 grade 5 events that we're seeing in this population. And so that is kind of one of the toxicity challenges. But I do believe the high rate of activity that you see with this agent is going to kind of make this an agent that moves forward in the HER2 space. And I think we'll see it actually potentially move even earlier forward as the objective response rate in PFS appears better than the current kind of alternative doublet kind of options that we're using currently for HER2 targeting in the HER2 amplified population.
So Axel, you were very much involved with this. I don't know if you actually have had any patients who received this agent. Can you comment on where you see it fitting in clinically?
Now it's actually off study. So we actually, based on the DESTINY data in gastric cancer and in colon cancer, have used actually this FDA-approved drug now off-label in studies. Mike really highlighted very importantly, I think it's a game changer for the treatment of patients with HER2 overexpression in colorectal cancer and in gastric cancer and in breast cancer. So it is really a unique mechanism of action. And I do believe it will eventually move from later line therapies potentially to an early line therapy. There's actually it's in a first line study. It's in planning right now in combination as a single agent and in combination with chemotherapy, because we have to keep in mind this is chemotherapy embedded in the HER2 targeted therapy. It's an antibody drug conjugate. So it can potentially even completely replace any standard chemotherapy options, even in a first or second line setting in HER2 overexpressing cancers. So hopefully we'll be able to get the toxicity, you know, that Mike pointed out, the ILD, the interstitial lung disease, as the main side effect or main threatening side effect under control, have better monitoring ways and strategies to deal with that. Because then the door is open for this drug to move into earlier line of therapy. And potentially, you know, at some point, we might even consider adjuvant treatment options, you know, for the very small group of patients with HER2-positive disease, perhaps based on, you know, identifying a high-risk group of patients based on molecular residual disease, MRD using ctDNA technology. You know, there's so much in the future, which is exciting for me. All the technologies we've talked about today will really change the way we treat, identify patients, you know, for certain interventions. It's one of the most exciting times in oncology ever.
So I'm curious also, in terms of the spectrum, I think I understand this correctly. As you both mentioned, this is HER2 amplified, like breast cancer, but yet in lung cancer, it's HER2 mutant. I guess that doesn't occur too much in colorectal cancer. Any comments on the spectrum of HER2 that you see in colorectal cancer, Axel?
So in HER2 mutations, we find them, we actually see this in our profile, but so far in colorectal cancer, those mutations have not really been at the same predictive value as clear HER2 overexpression by either protein assay or by ISH or CISH or FISH. So in this one, actually one of the questions in the study, the DESTINY colorectal cancer study, that the low expressors did really not benefit from this TDXD study, so this antibody drug conjugate. So the just mere presence of this antigen on the surface of tumor cells, like in the 1+ or 2+ setting, without amplification, really did not show a benefit for patients. And I believe, you know, the biologic value of HER2 is different for different tumor types. In breast cancer, it's clearly a driver of bad prognosis and bad biology. So targeting this is not just targeting this antigen and using it as a mechanism of action to really get the drug delivered into the tumor, but also it counteracts the bad biology that HER2 generates. In colon cancer and in gastric cancer, that's not as important, but it still works. And when we look at the higher expressors, that we can use this antibody drug conjugate binding to HER2 and then more or less selectively kill tumor cells.
Any comments, and I don't know whether you saw any of these patients, actually, about the interstitial lung problem that's been reported with all these trials with this agent?
Yeah, so this is actually, it's interesting because the onset was quite variable. It didn't happen right away. It came over time. And, you know, in these cases, which were ended up more severe, some of these subtle symptoms were likely missed initially because it's not the most common side effect that we see. Now, having said that, interstitial lung disease, the kind of drug-induced pneumonitis, can happen with various other agents. You know, I've seen it with oxaplatin, I've seen it with EGF receptor antibodies, I've seen it with alotinib. So there's a low risk of these ILDs in all patients, and we see it actually with checkpoint inhibitors, of course. And I'm personally very sensitive to that because I've seen very severe patients who severe clinical courses and have lost patients, you know, with ILD, not with this agent, but with other agents. And so I'm very, very sensitive to whenever I see interstitial infiltrate on our routine CT scans, wherever I stop therapy and initiate steroids, although we clearly do not have prospective data whether this steroid exposure, hydroxydexamethasone and prednisone, is really able to make a difference here. But hopefully, and Mike said, you know, this is one of the more important drugs and one of the more important side effects. Hopefully, we'll learn from the experience and be more sensitive and develop supportive care strategies for these patients.
So final question to both of you, just taking a breath and sitting back a little bit. Mike, what are the areas, what are the new trials that you're excited about seeing results of in metastatic colorectal cancer. Where are some of the things happening that you think are most exciting for the future?
I think we'd kind of get back to where we've kind of had success previously, which is, you know, various different molecular subtypes, right? I mean, I think clearly we have a lot of different subtypes where we're seeing activity. And so there's a lot of excitement of moving these kind of agents into earlier lines of therapy. And so we talked about, you know, this recent kind of HER2 targeted drug conjugate, you know, moving that earlier, clearly of extremely high kind of response rate and activity profile there. And so something that we could be using even earlier in patients. I think we talked about BRAF and looking at kind of early designs of BRAF targeted with chemotherapy, I think is a really exciting area. And then in the MSI space, you know, we've kind of mentioned the idea of, you know, combination versus monotherapy, a randomized trial really asking that question, which approach is better. And so I think we're going to have those trials are going to be happening. And so we'll kind of be able to see some benefits gained in these kind of various different molecular subsets. And that's probably where I have the most excitement going forward right now.
Same question to you, Axel.
So beyond what Mike said, two areas which I believe are really interesting. Number one, I do believe there will be a way to make non-immunogenic tumors immunogenic with more, let's say, combination therapies that are probably more rationally designed. Or if at all, you know, there are dozens of studies currently investigating immune checkpoint inhibitor combination with whatever is out there. And I hope that something will stick in the end and will move us forward and allow us to learn from it. So that's one thing, and that might be a little bit wishful thinking, you know, but I still hope and I believe that this is going to happen. Secondly, we've talked about the use of circulating tumor DNA here and there. So I strongly believe that this is a tool that will help us evaluate our treatment responses better, more rapidly perhaps than with a scan, especially when we talk about, you know, identifying patients might not respond right away to certain targeted interventions. And secondly, also, as highlighted before, to identify mechanisms of, you know, acquired resistance and really then be smarter in developing the next line of treatment. Now, this will require a different approach toward clinical trial design than what we've been doing so far. And we're probably not there yet to have the optimal clinical trial that would pass some rigor of scrutiny, you know, in terms of what the endpoints will be. But I believe that circulating tumor DNA as a tool will really shape the way we treat patients. We identify patients in early stage disease for treatment or no treatment, but also how we monitor patients on therapy and how we select our treatment sequentially.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.